From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Today on the show, meet an attorney who's eaten at 6,000 Chinese restaurants. Hoosier pie, shaker pie, and even green tomato pie. We'll look at the regionality of American pie. Jonathan Gold finds his new favorite soup dumplings in L.A. Plus, we'll visit a summer camp where kids create their own restaurant. But first, let's see what's fresh and in season this week at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. I'm visiting with Gavin Mills, who is the executive chef at a restaurant called Wood and Vine, which is at Hollywood and Vine. And Gavin, you're here at the market, as are so many other chefs and just home cooks and people who love food. Tell us today what you're looking for and what you're going to be preparing at Wood and Vine.
We have many things I'm looking for. I'm doing a five-course pasta dinner tonight, so I'm looking for that. I'm also looking for some peaches. I usually look for the white ones. They're usually a little bit sweeter this time of year. It usually goes to yellow after that. We do a grilled peach salad, so we kind of caramelize the peaches on the grill. It gives it a little smoke in here. It's a little more... Then caramelization of the sugars really transforms the flavor. We do that with just fresh Di Stefano burrata, reduced balsamic, and arugula. So it's kind of what I'm looking for right now.
So how do you pick your peach? Do you taste it first? And the other thing, peaches are so ripe when they come in. Do you have a problem handling them and getting them back intact back to the restaurant?
Yeah, I mean, I always try the peaches before I buy them. You know, I have a lot of relationships with all the farmers, so they let me try things. It's usually my breakfast of champions, which is peaches and apples and things of that sort. Then from there, you know, I look for the little firmer ones, the ones that can actually take being grilled, because if they're too soft, you know, it ends up not sticking. It sticks to the grill and, you know, it gets too caramelized. There's too much sugar. So I kind of look for the firmer ones, and then we slow roast them in the oven just a little bit to soften them up.
Do you, when you caramelize them, do you brush them with something first before you put them on the grill?
Yeah, we actually use extra virgin local olive oil and just a little bit of sea salt. And then we just grill them, give them nice little grill marks. And that's pretty much it. It's real simple.
Do you peel them?
I do not. I like the peel. I don't understand why everyone peels things. That's where all the flavor is. That's where all the nutrients are. I don't understand why we get rid of them in society. It's delicious.
And how long does it take to caramelize a peach? And do you have to flip it or not?
I don't generally flip it. I'll cut the sides off, the big sides of the peach, and then I'll just caramelize the flesh side, and then I'll turn them over. I won't turn them over on the grill, but I'll put them on a sheet pan and just roast them in the oven very, very slowly, about 225, 250, for about 15 minutes just to soften them up.
And when you shop on Wednesday, I'm sure this is on your menu all week, do you get peaches that'll last all week, or do you have to kind of refresh your supply on a Saturday or Sunday?
Well, with my restaurant, we actually go to the farmer's market every day. So we go 7 days a week, so there's always peaches available. We don't have a walk-in fridge, so everything we do is daily.
So 7 days a week and no cooler, that's amazing. So you're actually sourcing all week long. That's wonderful to hear. Thank you so much, Gavin. Really great talking to you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
That was Gavin Mills, and he's the executive chef at Wood and Vine, and he is sourcing locally 7 days a week for markets, which is fascinating, and all good things being done with peaches all summer long. Tomato season has finally arrived. How do we know this? Because Marianne Carpenter is back at the market herself with her first real crop of all the tomatoes. I know the cherry tomatoes came out a little sooner. Today, Marianne's booth is wall-to-wall amazing size, shapes, and colors of heirloom tomatoes that she has just made her signature commodity here at the market. So, Marianne, I'm just waist-deep in tomatoes here. Tell us a little bit about some of these varieties and how hard it's been getting them to market this year.
Well, actually, we've been really lucky this year. The tomatoes were earlier than last year when we had the June gloom and all the fog through July. So we have a nice crop. It's been warm, and it's been a really good season so far.
Okay, and you've got all the cherry tomatoes in, like, at least six different colors, and then all these nice, gnarly-looking heirlooms. Tell us what some of the varieties are.
Okay, well, we have a lot of different heirlooms. We've got, of course, the Brandywines. Everybody loves the pink Brandywines and the Cherokee Purples. Then we have a Marvel Stripe, which is a kind of a variegated looking with a red and a gold. And then we have like a Mandarin Cross, which is a solid gold tomato. Then, of course, we do our Early Girls, which everybody loves. And one of our favorite tomatoes is Evan Kleiman's Italian tomato. She's brought the seed back from Italy probably 15 years ago. Every summer we save our seed and plant our Italian tomatoes.
And what is the name of that one again?
Well, the official name is Costoludo canestrino. Of course, we have nicknamed it Evan's tomato.
And that's the really kind of ribbed sauce tomato.
Yes, that is a total cooking tomato. It's not that great fresh, but boy, it's awesome in sauces.
The heirloom tomatoes are just almost old news by now, but tell us what it is about them that makes them, A, so hard to grow, and B, just so flavorful.
Well, they're really susceptible to a lot of plant diseases. So when we have a really foggy and kind of damp summer, we run the risk of having a lot of mildew, which kills the plant. So that is something that we always are dealing with the heirlooms. We lost our whole last planting of tomatoes. We had 6 weeks of tomatoes that totally, we couldn't harvest one. The plants totally collapsed. It was really a sad, sad day.
You grow so many varieties and you sell to so many restaurants. For someone like me who's going to take these home and I just want to make a tomato salad or I want to make a sandwich, you can counsel me on what kind to get and also the care of tomatoes once they're home. I think rule number one is never put them in the refrigerator.
That's right. That's right. Never refrigerate a tomato. The best way to take care of them is to keep them on the counter, keep them on a tray. And for someone who wants to experience a really nice assortment of heirlooms, we give them a little selection, you know, a green one, a red one, a pink one, and it makes just a really beautiful mixed heirloom salad.
Okay, well, I love seeing the tomatoes and seeing them in their little boxes and all the arrangements and how you're sorting them out for everybody. So thank you so much for growing them and for bringing them in.
Well, thank you. It's our favorite time of year.
That was Marianne Carpenter from Coastal Farms, and they come to the Saturday and Wednesday downtown Santa Monica Farmers Markets all summer long, hopefully all the way through October. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
A recipe for Gavin Mills' grilled peach and burrata salad is on the Good Food blog. As you likely know by now, the so-called Corn Belt in the central U.S. is experiencing dire drought conditions. In fact, ag specialists are saying that this is the worst drought in five decades, and farmers are fearing that things could continue to get worse if rains don't materialize. Early this week on KCRW's To The Point with Warren Olney, reporter Alan Bierga described what he's seen on his trip through the Midwest.
This week I'm going to be going to central Illinois, which is one of the more drought-stricken areas. The I states, really, Illinois, Iowa, Indiana, are really bearing the brunt of this, especially Illinois and Indiana. You're seeing crop conditions where less than 20% of the crop would be considered in good or better condition. Last week I was in North Dakota, which is actually one of the more positive stories with the drought this year, ironically, because they had such a bad year last year. They were struck by floods. That left their soil with more moisture going into the season, and that's helped some of their crops get carried through.
Are they, though, dry this year, so they might be looking ahead to something bad next year?
Well, that is one of the worries that you're hearing from farmers, is they planted corn this year, like a lot of farmers did across America. We had record crop plantings, and they're now seeing sort of their soil get more dry. It's not that they've had ample rains. They've had enough to get through, and I'm hearing some corn growers saying that maybe next year they'll be doing sunflowers or a more drought-resistant crop because they think they may be the next wave.
Why is corn so profitable to plant when there's enough water?
Well, there's plenty of demand for it. I mean, between the fact that the U.S. exports more than two-fifths of all of the world's corn exports, you have cattle feed, about, 40% of corn goes straight to animal diets for protein. And then you also have ethanol, which in recent years has become nearly as important as animal feed as a competition for corn. You know, people think of the corn on the cob, but that's really a small portion of the crop. Most corn goes for industrial uses, and in recent years, there's just been ever more demand.
And what about the impact of exports if, in fact, the crop's as bad as you say it is?
Well, this is actually the big global question. The U.S. really is the world's granary in a lot of ways. We're number one in exporting corn. We're very competitive with wheat and soybeans. And when you take a look at global food supplies, a lot of countries are very dependent on those U.S. exports, and also, ironically, more exposed to the volatility of those prices than consumers in the U.S., which has sort of a more sophisticated, more highly processed and leveraged food market. So when you see big jumps in food prices in the commodities in the U.S., you'll actually see more dramatic food inflation changes overseas, especially in poorer countries, and that can lead to a lot of instability.
That was Alan Bierga, agricultural reporter for Bloomberg News, speaking with Warren Olney of KCRW's To The Point. A link to their complete segment on drought, king corn, and crop insurance is on the Good Food blog. As Alan said, a drought here in the U.S. hits hardest overseas, where commodity markets are most volatile. For instance, food aid from the U.S. comes from surpluses of the very crops that are in trouble right now. What does that mean for American food aid and nations battling hunger? Ray Offenheiser is the president of the nonprofit humanitarian organization Oxfam America. Oxfam's mission is to create lasting solutions to hunger, poverty, and social injustice around the world. I asked him what a drought here in the U.S. means for food aid worldwide.
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that immediately happens when we get a drought in the United States, or you get a drought in one of the big grain-producing countries, be it Australia or the Russia or the United States, is it affects global prices. And we live in a globalized market now. And so one of the things that I think all of us need to be aware of is a crisis in, for example, there was a seven-year drought in Australia, and it was part of what drove the prices for grains up in 2008 and created the global food price crisis in 2008. And now, if you're reading the press carefully and watching the analysis, you're basically seeing a concern that if we basically lose a high percentage of the corn crop in the Midwest, you know, we'll be consuming the part of it that we need, and we'll be putting 40% of our corn crop in our gas tanks. And then the question is, what will the surplus be that will actually be available for food aid down the road? And how will it affect the global marketplace where the prices are determined? Because what actually we learned from the last food price crisis is we had enough food in the world. It was the fact was the people in the poorest countries couldn't afford to buy it.
Taking a step back, I asked Ray to give us a primer on how food aid works. We all read about it in the news, but few of us really know how it functions. How does it get there? Where does it come from? Ray starts us off with an explanation.
Well, the food aid system was set up some years ago, in the post-Second World War period, as a way of sort of sharing the agricultural wealth of the American heartland with the rest of the world. And it's part of the agricultural bill that is passed every 5 years in the U.S. Congress. And the way it operates is that it presumes that here in the United States, it's generally been the pattern that we've produced a considerable amount of surplus food in the Midwest, and that we want to sort of be sure that we can put that surplus food out into the international market. And so what was arranged some years ago, and particularly in the 80s when we had enormous surpluses piled up all over the Midwest, was an arrangement where the U.S. government would buy that surplus from farmers, and then we would put it on U.S. ships, and we would send it around the world to emergency situations where there might be a drought or a famine or some situation where food was actually needed by populations, and we would deliver that food. And it's been a good program for many years. And I think the important thing maybe your listeners ought to know is that the United States is the largest contributor of food to the humanitarian system around the world through the U.S. through the World Food Program. And we contribute about 50% of the food that's provided around the world. There's a problem with it, the system, though, now, which is that basically we're not doing it particularly efficiently. And I think a lot of people think the system is broken, and there's a critique of it that maybe we might discuss.
I would love to discuss that. I know that one of the things that concerns people more and more is it seems like sometimes food aid, once it arrives in a given area, is commoditized. And then a certain amount of
leakage or corruption can come into play to siphon off some of the food aid?
At the present time, when we actually commit to sending this food overseas, we basically are buying it here from U.S. farmers, and then we're putting it – it's also required that we put it on U.S. ships and send it around the world to wherever it may be needed. But one of the things we've discovered, those of us who do this humanitarian work on the ground with these communities, is that very often that food takes a long time to get there. It may take a month or 2 months. You know, then it has to be transshipped overland to some of these remote corners of the world where it has to get to. So there's a timing issue, which is problematic. And there's also the fact that we're only spending 50 cents on every dollar for the food, and the other 50% is going for administrative costs and shipping. So if we organized a program where we were buying more food locally, then we could actually be getting the food there faster. We would be stimulating the local economy, and we'd be likely saving more lives, and we'd be avoiding some of the kind of distortions that, you know, this current program creates.
So it's interesting because in this new model that you're proposing, we would actually be helping the area that is suffering twice, one by an influx of money into their economy through buying a good from them, and then this food would then be distributed.
Right. We don't want to do away with the idea that we as Americans ship some of our food overseas because there are places where it is going to be needed. So that's not the idea. The idea is to say if we look at 100% of our budget for the food aid program now, what if we were to devote 25% of it to what would be called local purchase? And then say in an instance like a tsunami, when actually there was a lot of food available in places like Sri Lanka and India that you could buy maybe 50 miles away from where the emergency was taking place, we could literally get that there in 24 hours. And the money could be, you know, the money could be made available, the food could be purchased, and we can actually also enable farmers in those areas to get back up on their own feet pretty quickly because we're more agile, as it were, on the ground.
So is this a proposal that's now being discussed in the framework of the Farm Bill?
Yeah. What happens in the U.S. Congress is we discuss, debate, and approve a farm bill every 5 years. And 5 years ago, this issue was brought up. In fact, it was championed by the Bush administration. And their proposal was precisely what I'm saying, which was to devote 25% of the monies for food aid to local purchase. And we supported, actually, that proposal of the Bush administration. Now it's 5 years later, and the ag bill is being debated again, and the Obama administration is making the same argument for flexible ability to spend money for local purchase. What we have going on in Congress at the moment is there's some good news and some bad news. The good news is, on the Senate side, the idea of the program and pursuit of local purchase has been approved and institutionalized. That's the good news. The bad news is now we have to get a bill from the House side. And the House side is, more – the part of our Congress is more politicized on the budget issues and is, you know, obviously going to be tougher on these questions of new programs, budget line items, and so on. It'll be interesting to see whether this good idea might survive.
So now let's put this whole conversation about funding and the way we get the commodities there – into some sort of real context. What are the hot spots right now that you are most concerned about in terms of hunger?
Well, as your listeners probably know, there was a major food emergency in the Horn of Africa, in Somalia, Ethiopia, and Kenya last year. And, you know, many of our organizations have been sort of working to sort of meet the needs of populations in that area. And that situation, with some rains over the winter months, actually calmed that situation down. But there now are reports that, you know, it may this year again in Somalia, particularly in that part of the world, it may be returning. The other hot spot that we're keeping an eye on is West Africa, and about six or seven countries there, where there's been a drought period for over 2 years. You know, as we say in the United States, one of the dangers is if you start eating your seed corn, you're at risk because you're not going to be able to plant. Well, we see a lot of the indicators that we often see before, you know, during a drought period, of farmers putting themselves at risk. And so we're worried about whether, in fact, we're going to see an emergency there in the coming months. And if we do, it will affect some 18 million people, we expect. So it could be something on the scale of that, of what we saw in the droughts in the Horn of Africa last year.
Thank you so much. What a fantastic conversation.
Thank you so much, Evan, for having us.
That was Ray Offenheiser, president of Oxfam America. A link to their website and all of their inspiring humanitarian initiatives is on our blog. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood and click on recent shows. Coming up, we'll lighten the load a bit with a visit to a summer camp where kids create their own restaurant. Stay tuned.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
Welcome back to Good Food. Americans' obsession with all things food, from Top Chef to food blogs, has begun to infiltrate the younger generations as well. You may have heard of 13-year-old Flynn McGarry, who launched a successful supper club before he even finished the eighth grade. So you shouldn't be surprised to find a summer camp devoted to culinary pursuits. Good Food producer Jillian Ferguson recently visited Kitchen Kids Restaurant Camp, where kids aged 6 to 14 spend a week creating their very own restaurants.
So when I was a kid, I went to summer camp in the Blue Ridge Mountains in North Carolina. We spent our days canoeing, making friendship bracelets, and playing capture the flag. I have absolutely no recollection of what I ate, but I'm pretty sure it involved peanut butter and maybe some jelly. Needless to say, my camp experience was very different from Kitchen Kids Restaurant Camp in downtown Santa Monica.
We're making a restaurant, and our restaurant is going to be a Southern Comfort restaurant, and so we're making green beans with, like, onions and butter and all that kind of stuff.
The camp is held in a basement of a church in a spare banquet hall with an industrial kitchen attached. Activities at restaurant camp look remarkably like an episode of Top Chef Restaurant Wars. First, the kids are split into two teams. Then each team chooses a restaurant concept, logo, and a menu. When I visited, the concepts were sushi and Southern Comfort. Here's the 12-year-old mastermind behind the Southern Comfort meal.
My name is Major Levin. The Southern Comfort food reminds me of my grandfather a lot, and he grew up in the same town, fried chicken, the whole nine yards. So when I think of Southern food, I think of fry, a lot of fry. And I've seen chicken fried steak, fried chicken, but I haven't seen a fried burger, so I want to see how it turns out.
Yep, you heard him right. Deep-fried burgers were the main course for the Southern Comfort team. I'm not going to lie, I was a little surprised at this choice. Personally, I've never had a deep-fried burger, nor have I ever thought to make one. So I asked the camp director, Lynn Downey, if she had ever seen or had this unique concoction.
You know, I have not. I am skeptical, but I am open-minded. I'm always telling the kids that they can't tell you they don't like it unless they try. In Kitchen Kid, we like to say, don't yuck my yum. Because if I like it and you say, ew, I don't like it, then it's going to make me feel bad. So we say, don't yuck my yum. And if they try it and they don't like it, they don't have to have any more. That's, I guess, the rule that I'm going to have to live by when we deep fry burgers.
But to Major, a deep fried burger really isn't that weird.
I understand why she's skeptical. I don't think anybody's ever done this before. So, I mean, it does seem interesting to deep fry a burger. I mean, but chicken fried steak is also beef, so, I mean, what's the difference? Just grounded and, well, smaller.
The kids are encouraged to be creative, not just in the menu, but in how they design their logo and the name they pick out for their restaurant.
The original name, which got taken out, was the Defibrillator, but it was not going to sit well, so.
Eventually, this team settled on the much more palatable Roadhouse as the name of their restaurant. And along with green beans and deep-fried burgers, they had planned a vanilla pudding bar for dessert.
We're making vanilla pudding for dessert, and then we're going to have, like, a topping bar. So you can choose what you want, like, from assorted cookies and fruits and chocolate chips and all that. It's going to be really fun.
Over at the stove, Nicholas, who's 14 years old and the oldest in the group, was whisking the vanilla pudding in a saucepan.
Making a vanilla pudding, it's going to be really good. But because there's going to be a lot of people coming tomorrow, we had to triple the ingredients when we were doubling it. If you taste it after once the vanilla is added and you taste it, it's really delicious. It's a little lumpy, but it's still pretty good.
When the pudding was cooked, we all took a taste. And perhaps it was that doubling or tripling confusion, but there was no mistaking it. The pudding was kind of salty. And according to Lynn Downey, dessert is often the trickiest part of the meal.
One of the skills in the kitchen that gets a little bit confusing is baking, because you really have to be specific about your ingredients and the order of things. those tablespoon teaspoons are just mangy. They get so confused. You know, there's a T and a B right next to each other, or a T and a P. But, you know, I think that cooking is so good to just teach you that it's okay. You don't have to be perfect. That if you make a mistake, okay, how can we fix it? Or, well, we made a happy accident. Something good happened. So that's just another really great life experience to just be like, are we going to fall apart? Is everything horrible because we made one mistake? No, we're going to be fine. And I think that's really great for kids to learn early.
I'd put the salty vanilla pudding into the happy accident category. It was actually pretty good, kind of like salted caramel. I left the Southern Comfort team in the kitchen and went to find out what the sushi team was up to. They'd set up a table in the banquet hall where they were learning all about the other parts of running a restaurant, hospitality, etiquette, and service. But they took some time out to tell me about their menu.
A cucumber roll and a California roll. The cucumber roll has cucumbers in it. The California roll has cucumbers, that crab stuff. It has guacamole, avocado. It has avocado, and that was sesame seeds. For our drinks, there's ice cream, tea, and water. The dessert is a chocolate mountain cake. Chocolate Mount Fuji, because there's like a volcano, and I think there's a volcano
like a
in Japan.
Chocolate cake with a hole in it.
It's a chocolate pastry outside, and on the top it's a raspberry sauce.
Next, the sushi team did some role play. Half of the group pretended to be diners, while the other half practiced serving.
Can I start you with drinks?
Yes, please. I would like iced tea. Thank you.
Okay. How about you?
Can I have ice cream tea, please?
Of course.
These campers may be young, but they are still pretty tough customers.
Wow, was that a better waiter?
Yeah. The other ones are like, here you go, goodbye, here you go, goodbye. They don't really serve you what you want.
Earlier in the week, the kids visited Border Grill in Santa Monica. There they learned about the most important job in the entire restaurant, the dishwasher.
They have to learn that in this kitchen, they not only have to get all the supplies they need, they have to clean everything. So we don't clean anything. We hand the pot to them and say, go to town. Because in a real kitchen, they'd have to do that work too.
The campers will sort out who does those dirty dishes later. Meanwhile, the Southern Comfort team was putting the finishing touches on their meal. Ellie, who is 11 years old and I'm pretty sure taller than I am, was mixing together her version of In-N-Out Burger's secret sauce.
I've been making it for many years. My mom got a hold of the recipe, so now I make it and I put it on burgers. It's ketchup, a lot of mayonnaise, ketchup, and a hint of sweet relish. But the trick is the measurements, because otherwise it'll be too sour or too sweet or too bitter. You need to know the taste of each ingredient to see which one will make it sweeter, which one will make it sour.
By the way, if In-N-Out Burger is listening, she denies everything if you put her in court.
It is basically Thousand Island, but when you buy the dressing, it doesn't taste as good. It tastes a little more like, it's a little bit more thicker when you make it. And yeah.
With the secret sauce complete, lunch was ready to be served. And now it was that time for the moment of truth. They presented their Southern Comfort meal, and I took my first bite. The burger was pretty awesome. I'm not sure if it was the Hawaiian bread, the deep-fried patty, or Ellie's secret sauce, but it was totally amazing. And I wasn't the only adult who was surprised to learn that deep-frying a burger is actually not a bad idea.
I was stunned that they wanted to do a deep-fried burger. It kind of made me feel a little gooey in my tummy. It wasn't maybe the best idea, but I was really surprised because it was delicious, I'll admit it. So you never know. And I think what's really great that I've learned over the years is that you kind of have to really let them make the decisions and go for it fully, because you never know. We can bring our own ideas, but it's amazing what they can do on their own.
That was Good Food producer Jillian Ferguson reporting from Kitchen Kids Restaurant Camp, a summer camp for kids with culinary dreams. A link to their website is on the Good Food blog. Now it's that time of the show. You thought I was going to say Jonathan Gold is here, didn't you? We'll hear from Jonathan a little later. Right now, it's time for pie. It's always great to meet another pie baker, especially one who has a love of pie history, too. Meet Adrienne Kane. She's here today to share her take on the regional pie traditions that she explores in her new book, United States of Pie. So great to have you here.
Thank you. It's so great to be here.
Do you think that pie is a truly regional thing?
I think it can be. I mean, there are certain recipes that are definitely regional, like the Hoosier cream pie, which no one outside of Indiana really knows about or cares very much about.
But that's such a shame because it's lovely.
It is lovely, but it's very particular.
Could you describe it?
Sure. The Hoosier cream pie is interesting because it's obviously a cream-based pie, but it has no egg. So you use heavy cream and flour and sugar. So the flour and the cream sort of, in essence, make a roux, and it bakes slowly, and it's a very sort of dense, sweet pie.
I'd love for us to sort of do a brief tour of the United States of pie.
Okay. Well, in the Southern tradition, the pies tended to be very sweet. They didn't often use fresh produce. They used, you know, their peach pie, Southern peach pie, was sweet, and the peaches were canned, and they were sort of year-round. And then in the Northeast, it's apple country, I mean, and so there are a lot of apple pies and Concord grape pie. And then the West tends to be produce-driven and chiffon pie-driven because the chiffon pie is made in Southern California.
I didn't know that. Share with me a little bit of the Southern California chiffon pie tradition.
Well, it was invented by he called himself a pie engineer, Monroe Boston Strauss, in the 30s, and he was a dessert consultant for the Brown Derby restaurant and the Ambassador Hotel, and he sort of thought of mixing an egg-based, a custard pie, and stabilizing it with gelatin, and then you separate the eggs, and you whip them, and you don't bake them, but it makes sort of a cloud-like consistency and a wonderful voluminous filling.
Which is suited to a hot climate, to have something that's cold out of the refrigerator mm-hmm. and quite light.
Exactly.
And often flavored with fresh produce.
Mm-hmm. And then there's, of course, the Midwest, which tends to be sort of pantry staples, the pies that you can basically make out of things in your house to begin with, things in your kitchen. So sugar, cream, eggs, and dairy.
Chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
Is the Midwest cream pie central?
The Midwest tends to be cream pie central, just because in the turn of the century, that was where all of the dairies were in the country. And so they had a glut of dairy products.
Did you come across any surprises that when you cooked them, you went, oh my gosh, this is going to be a pie that I make over and over again?
I definitely came across that in the Concord grape pie, which I had never had before. I mean, a grape jelly I'd had and don't really care for, but the Concord grape pie is a little time consuming because you have to process all of the Concord grapes and pinch them, which is, you know, you leave the peel from the flesh, and then you have to cook the flesh and remove all of the seeds and add the peel back into it. So you have a day of what the women in Naples, New York call pinching. But then you can freeze the filling and you make a pie. I mean, I've told people who haven't had Concord grape pie, the nearest thing that I can equate it to is a blackberry pie without the seeds. It's just kind of tinged with the grape taste, but it has that lovely, like, tart-sweet combination. And so when I found that recipe, I've made that pie numerous times since.
many of us in Southern California have planted tomatoes this year, mm-hmm. which puts us within very easy reach of green tomatoes, those that have not yet ripened, not green because they're heirlooms. Mm-hmm. I hear you have a green tomato pie recipe for us.
I do have a green tomato pie recipe. It's actually from the South. And it's a wonderful way of using either green tomatoes or sort of right at the point in the year when it gets to be too cool, then you know that they're not going to ripen, and you're left with all of these green tomatoes. And it tastes very similar to an apple pie, and it's really delicious.
Do you treat the tomatoes the same way you would apples, by just like cutting them into wedges and tossing them with the thickener and the sugar?
I sort of do that. I mean, I slice the tomato like I would an apple, and the seeds that fall from the tomatoes I discard because I don't want the pie to be too wet. And you don't peel it, though. So it's different from an apple pie in that way. So it leaves sort of a chewiness about it.
Oh, very, very nice. Thank you, Adrian.
Thank you very much.
Adrian Kane's latest book is United States of Pie. A recipe for her green tomato pie is on the Good Food blog. And speaking of pie, have you entered your favorite pie in the 4th Annual Good Food Pie Contest yet? The contest is September 8th at LACMA. Every year, it just seems to get better and better. And so far, the judges include Jonathan Gold, Zoe Nathan, Roxana Julepat, Russ Parsons, and a few more. We'll be announcing a new crop of judges in the next few weeks, so stay tuned and get baking. Everything you need to know is at kcrw.com/pie. And speaking of pastry queen Zoe Nathan, I'm excited to announce that we're partnering with Huckleberry in Santa Monica for an awesome benefit dinner this Thursday, August 2nd. Everything you love about Huckleberry's delicious Thursday night dinners will be there. 3 courses of farmer's market fare, and pie for dessert, of course, all for just $30. The proceeds are going to go to put on this year's pie contest. So we need you to come. I'm going to be there. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood for details on how you can buy tickets. And trust me, the dessert alone will be worth coming. Up next, you think Jonathan Gold has eaten a lot of Chinese food? Well, I'll introduce you to a man who's eaten at over 6,000 Chinese restaurants. That's in 1 minute right here on Good Food.
This is producer Jillian Ferguson. You can connect with other food lovers on Evan's Facebook page, share photos, ask questions, and meet new friends. Search for Evan Kleinman on Facebook and click like.
I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food. Jonathan Gold is here. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, and he joins us each week with a restaurant recommendation. Today, he has a surprise for us.
Would you be surprised if I said we were going to San Gabriel for dumplings?
No, but actually, it would be welcome. We haven't gone there that frequently lately. So where are we going?
We are going to a restaurant whose name I'm about to butcher, Wee Tao Sheng Doodle House. And it's a pretty new restaurant, just a couple months old, which is right next door to Luscious Dumplings. Everybody loves Luscious Dumplings.
And, you know, it has the name.
It does.
It has an amazing name. So how can this place possibly compete with Luscious Dumplings?
It's an interesting question. And every time I've been in, the people in the restaurant have been people who have been frustrated with the line next door at Luscious Dumplings that have worked their way in. But in fact, this place has the two things that all of us are looking for in this world. One of which is Xiaolongbao, XLB, the soup dumplings, which they do an absolutely superb version of. And the other are, let's call them pot stickers for want of a better name, but the pan-fried dumplings. And all of us tend to go to Din Tai Fung when we're in the mood for soup dumplings. But at the moment, these might be my favorites.
Why?
The skins of the dumplings are not as bouncy, not as taut as they are at Din Tai Fung, but a little bit thicker, and there's like a soulful quality to them. When you bite inside, there's exactly the right amount of broth. And the broth is delicious. It's really concentrated. It's a little bit unctuous, but not too much. And then the pork itself is well seasoned. And if you get it with pork with fresh crab meat, the crab meat actually tastes like fresh crab meat instead of like something that came out of a can somewhere. Not saying anything about Din Tai Fung or any of the other places, but this freshness of the crab comes through. They might be using a good frozen brand. I don't know. Anyway, it's good. And usually you get this dish of black vinegar with like one or two wan little strands of ginger. And this time it's like a boatload of julienne ginger. And the black vinegar and the ginger is crunchy and refreshing. And the soup is hot and explodes in your mouth. And it's just a tremendous combination.
I love that. That sounds incredible. Now, what about the pot stickers?
Pot stickers come in many guises. These are, well, actually, I don't want to tell you what they're the size and shape of.
Are they shaped more like an egg roll, perhaps?
Oh, yes, that would work. And they're perfectly crisped on both sides. The noodle has a nice tensile strength, but it's not too al dente. And again, there's just a ton of juice in there. And you dip that in the homemade chili oil with a little bit of soy and vinegar. And those things just evaporate. They almost leap off the plate. There are two different kinds. There's the pork pot stickers and there's the beef pot stickers. The pork ones are the best by far.
I would suspect that there are other things on the menu. Do they merit our attention?
Sure. Why not? I mean, they're very proud of their cold fried tofu, which has a nice, like, soy sort of Chinese spicy flavor to them.
Well, now, wait a minute. Cold and fried would seem to be an oxymoron. So describe that a bit more.
Well, they're fried and then they're marinated. You know, they're soggy and they're cool and they have a nice juiciness to them and they're chewy. They're good to eat. There are, you know, your basic steamed dumplings, either with fish or with pork and cabbage or with other things. And a really nice, it's kind of a cheese ball version of Sichuan wonton, but the wonton's in chili oil. But they're delicious to eat.
Why do you say cheese ball?
Well, there's this sort of luxurious texture that you get at the best Shanghainese places and a lot of, like, Sichuan chili pepper going on in addition to the chili. So this, it's not the Sichuan version. It is a different version, but it's a version that you would not be sad if you ate.
What about noodles?
Of course there are noodles. The pork rib noodle soup, I think, is the one that I would get. It comes in a nice sort of concentrated pork broth. And there are three or four braised pork ribs on top of the soup.
Anything else you'd like us to try?
Well, you've probably got to try the leek pancakes, which are less pancakes than they are sort of flat dumplings that are filled with chopped sautéed leeks or with chopped sautéed leeks and pork.
Wow. Yum. Thank you so much.
Glad to be here.
I've been talking to Jonathan Gold about Wee Tao Zhang Noodle House on West Las Tunas Boulevard in the San Gabriel Valley. Get a text message with that restaurant that Jonathan talked about today by simply texting the words good food to the number 69866. That's good food to the number 69866. And don't forget that you can see all of Jonathan's restaurant suggestions on the Good Food Restaurant Map, which is on the Good Food blog. Think Jonathan has eaten his way through the San Gabriel Valley? Then you have to meet David Chan. He's a local Angeleno who could give Jonathan's Chinese restaurant knowledge a real run for his money. By day, he's an accountant and attorney, and you'd think he's a Chinese food-eating machine by night. He's eaten in over 6,000 Chinese restaurants, and there's no sign that he's planning on stopping anytime soon. His goal is to eat at every Chinese restaurant in Los Angeles at least once.
I'm a child of the 60s, and when I was a senior at UCLA, you had the first Asian American studies course. You just had the beginnings of ethnic consciousness. Now, you have to realize that from 1850 to 1950, most of the Chinese in the United States were from a very small rural area of southern China. give you an analog, it's as if all the Americans in China came from Victorville. I mean, it's that concentrated. And then in the early part of the 20th century, the federal government passed Chinese exclusion laws, which pretty much cut off the immigration of Chinese people to the United States. So with that background, what you had is you had the only Chinese in the U.S. were people from Toisan and their children. And what people in the U.S. knew of as Chinese food was really not terribly representative. And then we had the ethnic movement. At the same time, you also had a change in the immigration laws. And starting in 1965, people from China, Hong Kong, Taiwan were able to immigrate to the United States, and they brought their food with them. So you had, for me personally, there was a convergence of two things. I started to be interested in things Chinese, and Chinese food over here turned from bland to exciting. So slowly we started to see, especially in the L.A. area, we started to see authentic Chinese restaurants open. And the pace of their opening was manageable. I mean, it's like, you know, I had a bunch of friends, and if somebody found a new good Chinese restaurant, you know, we'd communicate with each other and we'd go there. So originally it was easy to have gone to every authentic Chinese restaurant in the Los Angeles area.
But then things changed considerably.
They changed considerably, but it was gradually. In other words, I probably started getting serious about Chinese food in the mid-1970s. It wasn't until maybe 10 years later that it was really an explosion of authentic Chinese restaurants, primarily in the San Gabriel Valley. And I, up to that point, I kept up to date. I'd been to all the places. I mean, my guess is maybe there are 800 authentic Chinese restaurants in the San Gabriel Valley today. Well, if you were to try today to start and eat at every one of them, half of them would be closed by the time you got up to. But for me, I was there at the beginning, so it's just a matter of keeping up with the places that open up.
I'm so curious. Have you kept a written record of what you've done, or is it all just banked in your memory?
Well, I have an Excel spreadsheet, which is actually doesn't have a lot of information. It lists the restaurants in numerical order, name of the restaurant, the street address, and the city, the year. And I created that, I guess, in the late 1980s, because as I mentioned, that was when things really started to explode. I thought to myself, you know, at this point, I better keep track of where I've been.
And that's also when you could really first start using an Excel spreadsheet.
Yeah, right. It was really basically, actually it was a predecessor database program called Reflex. But yeah, it was basically when I first got my first home computer, it's when I really put it down on paper.
You have this very focused way of eating, but I would imagine you eat out at other places too. So how many Chinese meals a week do you think you have?
Well, I probably go out 2 or 3 times a week for Chinese food. Some people do the math, and it's, as they say, 6,000. It says, gee, you had to eat at, you know, one Chinese restaurant a day for, you know, 20 years or something like that to hit that number. First thing, I've been at it for more than 20 years. But the second thing is that when I'm in town, you know, I only maybe go out for lunch 2 or 3 times a week. But when I go out of town and, you know, I can't eat at home, I'll eat at 4 places a day. So that's what really brings the numbers up.
So you're out of town on business, I would expect.
Primarily, yes.
How do you manage to fit 4 meals in a day and also accomplish what you need to do for your job?
It's not difficult. I just plan things out. Sometimes I'll go down to Chinatown in New York, for example, in the morning, and maybe I'll buy enough for lunch and dinner.
Do you ever repeat meals? Like if you find a place that just somehow just hits your comfort zone here in L.A., do you go back?
Well, I mean, that's a downside of the quantity aspect, because as long as there's, let's say, a new Chinese restaurant that I've heard of that opened up in Monterey Park, I'm going to go there before I go back to some place that I really like.
And in all of this eating, you may have experienced a tremendous depth in each regional cuisine of China. Is there any that are your particular favorites?
My favorite is Hong Kong Cantonese, because I'm Toisanese and you know, we're Cantonese-type people. There's also a saying in China that lists, you know, the best of everything in China. And they say, you know, if you're going to eat, you eat in Guangdong, you know, southern China, Canton area.
What is the flavor profile of those particular dishes?
Cantonese food is probably the mildest with the Chinese cuisines because everybody knows Hunan food, Sichuan food, that they're very spicy. I guess Hong Kong Cantonese-style food, it's known for being flavorful, a lot of seafood, it's rice-based.
And known for a certain kind of wok cooking.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And here in L.A., where would be the places that we would go to have great experiences?
There are a number of really outstanding Hong Kong-style Chinese restaurants here. There are two in particular that is pretty much consensus as to the best in the area. One is called Sea Harbor, and the other is called Elite. Sea Harbor is interesting because they opened up about 10 years ago. They're actually based in China, but they had a branch in Vancouver. And Vancouver, British Columbia, or actually the suburb of Richmond, has by far the best Chinese food in North America because it has the greatest Hong Kong influence. So Sea Harbor was the first, and in fact, I think they're still the only Vancouver or Canadian Chinese restaurant that has opened up in the Los Angeles area. They're located in Rosemead. Elite is in Monterey Park. It just brings a more refined, higher quality type of Chinese food over here. You see it in Vancouver, you see some in the Bay Area, see it in LA, you see it in Toronto. You don't see it in New York.
Is that because the immigration patterns are different?
Right, because to me, although people will disagree, but I think a major influence on how good Chinese food is the extent of Hong Kong influence, because Hong Kong is where not only you probably have the best Chinese food in the world, but they continue to innovate. And you see a Hong Kong influence in LA, San Francisco, Vancouver, Toronto. You don't see it in New York. And I think the reason is that New York, even though they have a large immigrant population, it's from a different area. It's from Fujian, which is the next province up the coast from Guangdong province. And that's a less culinary cuisine. And that's also, I think, equally as important is the fact that that's a more working class category of immigrant they have in New York than we see out here in California.
When you're traveling, how do you find where to go eat? Is it word of mouth from friends?
Well, the internet's made it a lot easier. But I have found that most dim sum restaurants in the United States are geared toward Chinese diners. And they'll serve dim sum in the afternoon, and they'll serve usually Hong Kong-style seafood in the evening. So if I can figure out which Chinese restaurants serve dim sum, that's sort of a toehold. And then once you get into the community, what you do is I grab a Chinese newspaper. I don't read Chinese. I don't speak Chinese. But their ads usually has the English name and an address. And if a restaurant advertises in a Chinese language newspaper, you know that they're targeting Chinese clientele.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me, Evan.
That was David Chan, accountant and attorney by day, Chinese food eating machine by night. He's eaten at over 6,000 Chinese restaurants. Find a map with some of David's restaurant picks and recommended dishes on the Good Food blog. Do you have a favorite Chinese restaurant? What do you order there? Join our conversation on my Facebook page. Search for me, Evan Kleiman, and click like. I've got more good food coming up for you right after this short break.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day, and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive Angel Clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. We can't talk about Asian food without talking about night markets. Unless you've traveled to Asia, you probably haven't experienced one. But Sang-Yoon of Father's Office in Luxion is going to change that. Next Saturday, August 4th, he's bringing his Lucky Rice Night Market to the Helms Bakery in Culver City. I asked him to give us some background on traditional night markets.
Well, anyone who's ever traveled to Asia has probably been through one, whether you wanted to or not. And it's kind of like a place where people shop for food, groceries, ingredients, as well as go to eat. It's sort of like a food market and a rugby match kind of mashed together. There's a lot of people at night markets, and it's almost uncomfortable, but they're frenetic, crazy places that operate primarily at night, sometimes open air, and just the sights, the sounds, the smells are pretty intoxicating, pretty alluring.
And each food producer is in their own separate little stall.
Yes, every little vendor has their own stall. It's amazing the amount of repetition. You see a lot of dried seafood vendors. You kind of see the same things over and over again. So a lot of night markets don't have a lot of variety, but the thing we're going to do here is sort of a higher-end night market. We're going to, you know, bring it up a few notches.
When I heard about the Lucky Rice Festival, the thing that intrigued me was I realized we had to have reached a critical mass of chefs making finely curated Asian food for this to happen.
I think it's happening. If anyone who's grown up in L.A. has watched Asian cuisine just proliferate. It's always been in the San Gabriel Valley. We've always had our Koreatown, our Thai town, but those cuisines have really spread out, and now more and more chefs like myself and people, my peers, are really, whether you're of Asian descent or not, are really embracing Asian cuisine wholeheartedly. A great example is Brian Ng from Spice Table. He was making pizzas at Moza, but his background is he's from Singapore. And, it's nice to see someone young, enthusiastic, and talented wanting to do the cuisine of his own culture. And that is something that's, I think, really new for chefs. There's an open license to do that now.
Give us a sort of peek into who's coming, who are the chefs that are coming, and what kind of food can we expect from them? What will the range be?
Oh, we have a few people from the East Coast this festival, the Lucky Rice Festival, originated in Brooklyn, and this is in its third year. It's its first year outside of New York. We're getting Eric Bruner Yang from Toki Underground in Washington, D.C. We're getting Susser Lee from Toronto. He's coming down for this. Susan Feniger, and she's going to be doing some Asian-inspired things from street. We also have Parks Barbecue and Night Market and Jet Tila from Charleston and some of the really great local Asian chefs.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Sang.
My pleasure.
That was Sang Yoon, chef and owner of Father's Office in Lukshin. His Lucky Rice Night Market is next Saturday, August 4th, at the Helms Bakery. Details are on the Good Food blog. Before I go, I want to invite you to join our Pie a Day Fun on Instagram. We have a growing gallery of pie, both on the Good Food blog and at kcrw.com/pie. And all you have to do to participate is snap a photo of pie on Instagram, hashtag it with the words Pie a Day. You'll see your photos appear in our gallery amidst dozens of other pie pictures. And don't forget to join me this Thursday, August 2nd, at Huckleberry in Santa Monica for a delicious dinner benefiting KCRW's 4th annual Good Food Pie Contest. I guarantee you good food and good company. Details are all at kcrw.com/goodfood. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com or via iTunes. You can also find Good Food on Demand on KCRW's apps for the iPod, Android, and BlackBerry. Good Food is produced by Jillian Ferguson. Lara Garcia is our segment producer, and our executive producer is Harriet Ells. A special thanks to Ronnie Mickelson, Gary Masiha, and Sarah Rogozin. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll see you back here next week for another edition of Good Food.